Your headlines for this hour: Lebanon's Hezbollah chief says the resistance movement is ready to send Israel back to the Stone Age if the regime wages war against this country. A new poll shows the majority of Israelis believe that the regime is on the verge of economic, social and political collapse. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the US and some European countries orchestrated last year's riots. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, the Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has warned the Israeli regime against waging a war on Lebanon. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah says in case of a war, the movement is ready to send the regime back to the Stone Age. Nasrallah also warned of a crushing response to Israel's violation of Lebanon's rights to its natural resources. The Hezbollah chief said the Israeli regime's military power has significantly declined since 2006, a fact that Tel Aviv's officials have confirmed or admitted. He also called for calm inside Lebanon and the peaceful resolution of internal issues while warning against pushing Lebanon towards a civil war. Nasrallah was delivering a speech on the 17th anniversary of Israel's defeat in the 33-day war against Lebanon in 2006. In Israel, months of violent protests against a highly controversial judicial overhaul plan have led to a severe internal crisis. A new poll shows the majority of Israelis believe that the regime is on the brink of an economic, social and political collapse. The poll conducted by an Israeli institute suggests that over 58% of people believe that the regime has entered a state of emergency. This following last month's passage of a bill that will see the highest court stripped of most of its powers. This tracks with an earlier polling that showed the majority of Israelis have lost faith in the future, with nearly one-third of them considering leaving the occupied territories. The planned judicial overhaul, which was proposed in January, has sparked massive protests and criticism both at home and abroad. Professor of Political Science Mohammer Abu Saada says the Israeli regime is brutally oppressing not only Palestinians, but its own people. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli government, whether are the left governments or radical right-wing governments, they all have been brutally oppressing the Palestinians for about 75 years now, since the day of the Palestinian Nakba in 1948. But it's unheard of to see the current right-wing Israeli coalition government to deal with its own Jewish citizens in a very rough way. We have seen over the past 8 months incidents where Israeli police and Israeli border police beating some of the Israeli protesters. There were incidents in which some Israelis were car ramming other Israeli protesters. A number of incidents that have taken place over the past 8 months in which a number of leading Israeli personalities have warned of an Israeli civil war as a result of the split inside the Israeli society between those who are favoring the judicial reforms like the left, the right wing and the radicals, and those who are opposing those judicial reforms.
Lebanon is marking the 17th anniversary of Hezbollah's victory over Israeli forces in the 33-day war. The Tel Aviv regime's air and ground invasion triggered a strong response by the resistance movement. The war ended following a UN-brokered ceasefire, not only put an end to the confrontation between the Israeli army and the resistance forces, but also ushered in a new era for Hezbollah's achievements. Our correspondent in southern Lebanon, Mariam Saleh, explains.
That was the time when the Israelis basically were not only defeated, they did not accomplish any of their objectives during that time. And August 14th, you saw hundreds maybe thousands of people who were from South Lebanon. They came back to their homes even on the same day, just an hour after the ceasefire, on August 14th at 8 a.m. when the Israeli hostilities stopped. And then the Israelis were still pulling up their tanks from some areas at the border. We had thousands of people packed up, ready to return to their destroyed homes, despite the fact that there were no roads, there were no bridges. People were stopping their cars, walking for long distances, or waiting for in their cars for hours until there was some sort of a road that the army had opened in order for them to return. We saw these images with our own eyes. So therefore, this did not just signal the end of a war or the end of a confrontation between the Islamic Resistance, the Hezbollah, and the Israeli army, which is something that people before the year 2000 were used to. They were used to this continuous confrontation. However, what we saw was actually a new phase. The Israelis, in addition to not accomplishing any of their objectives, they were not able to defeat Hezbollah. Hezbollah's arms are still intact. Hezbollah's power is still intact. They are gaining strength, gaining momentum. Sayyid Nasrallah has said on and on that they have more than 10,000 rockets. He said this after the year 2006, so now it might be even more than maybe tens of thousands of rockets, perhaps. So we have that gaining strength for the resistance, and at the same time, you have more support for Hezbollah. And also with the Israelis, you have more investigations against this war. The fact that it was a failure, the fact that whether the military leadership, political leadership, they were even at odds with each other. They were blaming each other on what has happened in the war. The fact that they did not have any strategy that was successful.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip are left with seriously contaminated water due to years of Israeli blockade and multiple military attacks. Ashraf Shannon has the details in the following report.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least 3 times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
It's been nearly a year since deadly riots broke out in Iran and shook the country for months. Iran has blamed Western countries for the unrest, a position reiterated by President Ebrahim Raisi. He says the U.S. and some European countries, as well as other adversaries of the Islamic Republic, orchestrated the riots. The Iranian president said they targeted the peace, security and businesses of Iranians. Raisi, however, said the people foiled the plot through steadfastness. The unrest erupted in September 2022 after a young Iranian woman died in hospital days after collapsing at a police station. A forensic investigation dismissed allegations that she was beaten at the police station and attributed her death to an underlying medical condition. Tehran strongly condemned Sunday's terrorist attack in the southern city of Shiraz, saying terrorists are trying to retaliate for the heavy blows Iran dealt to them. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said terrorists target innocent civilians out of anger over their humiliating defeat. Kanani also highlighted as decisive the role of late Iranian Commander General Qasem Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists and Israel. Earlier, President Ebrahim Raisi ordered an immediate probe into the deadly terrorist attack, which left at least two people dead and several wounded, some critically. A gunman opened fire at an entrance of the Shah Cheragh Shrine on Sunday. The assailant was arrested at the site. Security forces have also detained 10 foreign suspects over the shooting. During our news review program, we discussed the Iranian foreign minister's recent remarks on the unblocking of the country's funds in South Korea.
And now it's time for this hour's news review. Well, Iran said it is committed to resolving the 2015 deal through diplomacy, but it will not settle for a temporary or limited agreement. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment in a televised press conference. He added that Tehran has always wanted to return all parties to full compliance with the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA. Amir Abdollahian said that removing Washington's unilateral and unfair sanctions through diplomacy has always been on the government's agenda. On the unblocking of Iranian assets in South Korea and a prisoner swap with the U.S., he stressed that they are two independent and unrelated issues.
The Iranian funds in South Korea are unfrozen and given back to the Islamic Republic, which is our right. The prisoner swap is completely a humanitarian issue, and we do not consider any connection between that and the unfreezing of our assets.
He added that with the mediation of a third country, Tehran and Washington held separate meetings regarding the prisoner swap and the unfreezing of Iranian assets. The top diplomat said the assets were transferred from South Korean banks to a European bank. Billions of dollars were illegally frozen by Seoul for several years as a result of U.S. sanctions. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. John Busnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade, and John Stepling, author and commentator out of Norway. Thank you both for being with us on this news review. Let's start this off in Belgrade, John. Well, if we hear the mainstream media, corporate media reports, it's as if Iran has been paid some ransom money because of these individuals who have been released. At the same time, Iran is saying and repeating the fact that this money belongs to Tehran, that it has been illegally actually taken by the U.S. and frozen by the U.S. because of sanctions. Your take, John. I mean, why are we seeing what we're seeing in mainstream media and the reality of it all?
Well, there's an old English saying that the proof is in the pudding. And in fact, tasting of this pudding is now taking place. And we're seeing that America has had to admit that what it did through its colonial administration of South Korea was to steal the property of Iran. And I think this is a reflection of a broader series of setbacks to America and its imperial activities, most recently in Ukraine and previously in Syria. The writing is on the wall. The American empire is wavering and falling, and they have to start to behave within the law, or they're going to face the interworld against them, and not just the countries that they have targeted.
Well, John Sepling, your take on the significance of Iran actually being able to get their funds back from South Korea, and what does that say in general? Because usually with the United States in actually talking about or making deals, not always do they stand by their word. But this time around, Iranians were freed from the United States who had been in prison, and also Tehran was able to secure some of its sanctioned funds. Your take on the significance?
Well, I think that it's certainly useful for Iran to get their funds back, or most of them. And Mr. Bosnich's point is correct. The optics for the U.S. in this are not particularly good. And this is, if we look at the broader picture for the U.S. optics in general globally right now, they are not very good, from Afghanistan to the lost war in Ukraine, the proxy war against Russia. Certainly the Defense Department continues to make money and so forth. But what's interesting, and you touched upon this with mentioning corporate media, mainstream media, if you read the coverage of this prisoner swap, one actually self-identified leftist publication began the article by praising Joe Biden's courage in making this prisoner swap. It's breathtaking how biased and distorted Western media has become. You get nothing like a historical perspective that is in any way accurate. There have been countless prisoner swaps. The U.S. swapped prisoners with Iran in 2016 and 2019. For the entire 20th century, we have seen significant prisoner swaps involving the United States, the Portland spy ring, the Anna Chapman case, Alan Gross, et cetera, et cetera. But this coming at this time, because timing is always an issue, is interesting because Biden is facing an election soon, in theory, and he probably needs some good press, and this is trying to get spun in corporate media as a positive, as a courageous, and that the United States has broken a deadlock and has returned to statesmanship and diplomacy. And it's idiotic. It's not true, of course, at all.
I appreciate both of you being with me on this news review. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst out of Belgrade. John Sepling, author and commentator out of Inderøy, Norway. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another review.
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Take care for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من. این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزای لازمی است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. 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 کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
France's colonial rule in Africa began in the 19th century. Many might think that the days of cruel exploitation, massacre, slavery, and psychological abuse of African people in the hands of the French have come to an end. But the recent developments in countries like Niger show Paris still has its hand over the continent. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. According to Tehran Times, the latest African country to rise up against French dominance is Niger, where the military managed to overthrow the Western-backed government of Mohamed Bazoum in July. Western regimes have resorted to their usual tactic and began a propaganda campaign against the coup, which in fact seems to enjoy the support of most Nigerian people. Instead of talking about why the coup has happened and what people had been demanding from the previous governments, the West has decided to reduce the event to an authoritative act and call it a threat against democracy. The American and European governments reacted exactly the same way when similar events happened in Mali and Burkina Faso in 2021 and 2022. The two countries, similar to Niger, finally drew a line in the sand and decided to root out French influence so that African people can determine the fate of their own nations. The people of Africa are fed up with being kept in poverty and struggling to put food on the table, while France exploits their natural resources and fills its own pockets with African filth. The simple fact that Africans no longer want France's stealing is something you will never hear from Western media. To understand what's exactly been sidestepped by the West, we will be taking a look at France's colonial past in Africa and how it continues to exploit the continent today. The British and the French colonized 95% of the African continent at one point. France colonized 20 nations, including present-day Senegal, Mali, Burkina Faso, Benin, Guinea, Ivory Coast, and Niger, which are all located in West Africa. The tales of French colonization of West Africa are perhaps some of the most harrowing and chilling stories in the history of mankind. The French were notorious for resorting to extremely cruel and inhuman methods when things didn't go their way. They stripped African people of their clothes, put heavy chains on them, clipped their body parts to the wall, raped their women and children, and tortured them in ways unimaginable. We do not have to go far in history to encounter a horrifying act by the French, like how they used bones of Algerian people to make soap. France has committed enough crimes in recent past for us to fill up the entire page. During its 1.5 centuries of direct colonialism, France has killed hundreds of thousands of African people for different reasons. For instance, on the morning of December 1, 1944, French forces committed the Tiaroye massacre. They killed hundreds of Senegalese troops returning home after fighting in the Second World War once the soldiers demanded personal rights and payment. It was as if Senegalese people should have felt honored to simply fight and die for France in the war, and they were not allowed to ask for anything more. It is important to note that France has never paid compensation for any of the inhumane crimes it has committed. If you ask a French person today, they might laud their ancestors for bringing modernism to Africa and helping the people of the continent become more humane, various renowned writers and historians have pointed out. This notion that non-Western people are lesser than still prevails throughout Europe and the US. France still continues its colonialism of Africa through agreements and administrative practices. Paris loots the natural reserves of 14 African countries today, namely Benin, Burkina Faso, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, Mali, Niger, Senegal, Togo, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, Congo, Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea and Gabon. France has been earning hundreds of billions of dollars each year through these agreements. To understand the Western hype about the coup in Niger, we must know that at least 20% of France's nuclear electricity is generated by using the uranium ore it steals from the African country. After Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso, if the rest of these 40 nations decide to get rid of French dominance, the future of France's economy and welfare might lie in shambles. At the time of reading this article, Western governments are weighing the launch of an incursion into Niger to bring the government of Bazoum back. We must wait and see whether other states in West Africa would decide to function independently and finally help their own people, or would get militarily involved in Niger and allow France to continue looting Africa's resources.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. This is IRIB English Radio, the program of Viewpoint. I am Beaton here. Again, I'm honored to be the host of today's episode. And here with me, there are two dear guest speakers, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Ali here with me. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for being here with me. And as you know, again, this episode, we're going to talk about something really common among our youth generation. A problem, maybe, we can call it. Because, as you know, in this modern world, we are facing depression more than any time in the human history. Depression, you know, wasn't that much accepted as a disease. But nowadays, as it is so spread around among people around the world, actually in psychological aspects and even biological aspects, we assume it and we actually name it as some spiritual and psychological disease that I think all of the people around the world have actually gone through this in every period of their life. I don't want to go through the reasons of this depression that we feel, especially in this generation nowadays, but actually I want to go through the ways that we can prevent this disease from going and spreading around. And one of these things that I think is confronted and facing this depression is social happiness. Actually, happiness is really complicated nowadays because we can see many people with you know, high level of facilities, money, and even some celebrities that they are not happy. Just, you know, they commit suicide and so on. And all of these things are the proof to whatever you told up to here. And so there should be some true meaning of happiness, which is divided and separated from all the outer standards that we set up to here, like money, like facility, or anything. And as you told, there is this Islamic point of view on happiness that we have to go through the true path that actually is matched with our personality and humanity. And what do you think, Brother Ali, about the Islamic point of view in this regard of this social vitality and happiness that we lack in this modern world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Happiness is one of the basic human emotions that plays a decisive role in ensuring the health of the human body, the human being, and also the society. Happiness, regardless of how it is being acquired, it can improve physical health of the person. So we see that happy people usually make better decisions, feel more secure, yeah, and actually more vital and have a cooperative spirit in the society. So this is quite tangible for us to see. So happiness, there is no doubt that it has a very important role in one's life. But the basis of the creation of the whole universe and existence is in such a way that actually it automatically provides a sense of happiness for the people. The sunrise, or the, yeah, gentle morning, or pleasant spring, or a beautiful waterfalls, or the nature, looking, yeah, at, yes, the nature, or the sea, the kind of peace and tranquility that looking at the sea gives to a human being. Or colorful flowers and the connection of the two people when they come together, whether they are, for example, a couple or two old friends that when they meet each other. So these bring happiness to a person. So suppose a person is lacking all of these elements and at least is indifferent towards all of these things. So what would be the outcome? I mean, the person would not feel this sort of happiness inside himself or herself. One more element of happiness that we have been ordered in our Islamic teachings is that we, the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, are happy with whatever actually makes the Ahlul Bayt happy. In the times, yeah, of, for example, giving birth to one of the noble imams, or even when we have been, for example, we have been ordered to be happy in such occasions. And really, it brings a sense of happiness for us. And we are all happy when we have some congregations and some assemblies, and we are happy on those ceremonies. Though some even better incidents also occur in opposite, but now since our discussion is about the happiness, so we are talking about this. But the limits that Islam defines for happiness is that we, a person, a Muslim, a duty-bound person, should not indulge in excess, that is, in, yeah, extravagance in happiness. So, for example, Islam suggests us to have such happiness, for example, in halal and, for example, halal relations or communications.
Yeah, thank you, Brother Ali. So just let's keep it here and go through this part that, okay, we have different categories of happiness. One of them is passing happiness, which it's not going to last forever. So maybe 2 hours for most. And we have that higher level of happiness that you actually described so beautifully. And the question which we have here is that from some point of view, the happiness for sure is not the goal. You know, we have higher level goals and destinations here. And another part of our Islam, our religion, is about the mourning, about the about the dark part and the sad parts of the religion we have, especially in our history of religion, and especially in 2 months of Muharram and Safar, that we go through these gatherings and mourning, and we mourn for the all of the things that happened in the past. Is there any actually conflict between the feeling of happiness that we have to taste and these mourning and ceremonies that we go through in this month? Or no, they are actually mashed together. Sheikh Rouhani, what do you think?
Apparently, it seems that when we attend, for example, these kind of gatherings in which we mourn for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi wassalam, it seems that it gives us a kind of sorrowful kind of feeling or sad kind of feeling, and there is no kind of happiness or, let's say, tranquility or feeling of happiness in these kind of gatherings. But in reality, the case is totally different. If I want to explain it by an example, I want to mention this example that when you are in need of someone, for example, you are fully in need of something, and you are, for example, asking someone or begging someone to help you, to give you something. Before you've been given something, of course, you are very much sad, unhappy, a feeling of kind of sadness in your heart, and you feel like very badly, we can say sadly, but the moment that you're given something, your feeling, your mood totally changes, and you will feel like the most happy person in the world. In these kind of mournings for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi wasalam, the people are like this. When they mourn for Abu Abdullah alayhi wasalam, when they attend, when they participate in these kind of gatherings, they ask something for Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. They have some needs to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. This kind of need motivated the people to attend every year repeatedly in the whole life of them in this kind of gathering. This is the feeling of need, let's say poverty in the presence of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam, that makes, that caused the people to commemorate Abu Abdullah al-Husayn's martyrdom every year repeatedly, and it has never become something old. It is always new, it is always fresh, it is always enjoyable. Every year it is new for the people. So now the question is that where does it come from, this kind of feeling? It is because of this, that every year when the people commemorate Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam, mourn for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wasalam, at the end of the day, it gives them a feeling of happiness, a feeling of kind of satisfaction.
Yeah.
That is the reason that the people always gather for Abu Abdullah alayhi salatu wasalam. They mourn for Abu Abdullah alayhi salatu wasalam. It is totally different when we mourn, for example, for the one we lose, like our father, brother, for example, or maybe sisters or children. Of course, in those cases, only the feeling of sadness is there.
Yeah.
Then we cannot compare it with these kind of gatherings for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi wasalam. Though there is sadness, but within this sadness, in the deepest layer of this sadness, there is happiness.
Thank you, Sheikh Rouhani.
Yeah, that's why it's a kind of different sort of experience.
So, somehow you're the supporter of this philosophy that this actually mourning and this sadness is the base and establishment of the spiritual happiness that we can actually taste it through all this sadness. But I think despite the fact that we have this way to achieve this actually deep happiness and deep level of happiness, for our youth generation, still there should be some suggestions, there should be some ways and methods to increase this actually social happiness more and more. What could be these ways? Brother Ali?
Like, as we said earlier, Islam is, if we look at the Islamic teachings, for example, in the books that actually usually talk about the functionality of Islamic rituals, like Tabarsi, if we look at those books, we see that the kind of hadith, that the orders and recommendations that come to us to encourage us towards how to bring happiness in our life is way more than what we have about, for example, the customs of Azadari and mourning.
Yeah.
See, so if one wants to actually make a comparison, they can find this difference, the kind of way that Islam tells us how to, for example, wear clothes to make you more happy, how to, for example, eat food to taste it with more eagerness, or how to, for example, go out and how to go to, for example, your vacation, and how to spend your vacations and different occasions that Islam wants you to be happy. So in these occasions that there are plenty, again, we have also some occasions that Islam wants us, for example, to practice or to do whatever has been known as the sunnah of the Prophet and with the prophets. Look, in Quran we have that the Prophet Jacob, yeah, was crying for his son Joseph, Yusuf alayhi salam, that he cried a lot, that that his eyes became white as much as he cried over this distance that he had from his son, his beloved son. You see, the same time we see the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the amount of actually mourning, the cry that he made on Hamza Sayyid al-Shahada, or even his son Ibrahim, his little son that he passed away. So at the same time that we need to tune our relations and our emotions in some sort, yes, of the way. Even in medicine, they say that as much as, for example, your body needs sugar, the same amount, for example, or in a certain amount, this body requires, for example, salt. But I want to say that all of them have their own functions, but we have been ordered to, even the amount, I want to compare, that the amount of the recommendations for happiness, or how to make ourselves and families happy, way more than the recommendations for the mornings. But one more point, even the followers of the school of Al-Bayt have made some innovations that makes this ceremonies of Imam Hussein alayhi salam again a case of happiness. How? It's quite famous that if you are invited somewhere, you become happy that you have been invited and entertained by somebody. But the one who entertains you or provides you a food or something, he feels more happiness inside. Yeah. I think you have yourself experienced that. You give something to somebody to eat, you are more happy than the one who is eating the food, for example.
Yeah.
So this brings us again an inner peace for the person that actually again changes this environment into a happy program.
Thank you, Brother Ali and Sheikh Rouhani, for being here with me in this episode. Actually, happiness is a bit more complicated than what it seems to be. But at the end, we come to this point that, okay, there may be some periods of time that you feel like this sadness and these dark parts and difficulties and so on. And this is, again, a shape of happiness. And it depends on your viewpoint, again. The way you have to look at life, the way you have to prioritize your values, and at the end, the most important thing is to just being happy and being satisfied with whatever God blessed you with. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. I actually wish it was useful for you. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry, while little children die. Hussein said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. they can't bear to watch you leave. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein, Hussein, ya Hussein. This is Karbala. Oh, Zainab left her heart. She left her brothers in the dust. But there's much more pain to come. This is the road to Shire. She won't make the journey home. She cries, Ya Hussein, Ya
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Special counsel investigations of former US President Donald Trump have cost over $9 million in just 5 months. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The U.S. national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Special counsel Jack Smith's two investigations of former President Donald Trump have cost more than $9 million in the first 5 months after Jack Smith was tapped in November of 2022 by Attorney General Merrick Garland to oversee the Justice Department's ongoing Trump-related investigations, according to expenditure statements released on Friday, 7th of July. Jack Smith is investigating efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election and Donald Trump's alleged mishandling of classified White House records after he left office. When Smith took over, both probes were already in progress, and in June, prosecutors secured an indictment against Donald Trump and his longtime aide, Walt Noether, for an alleged scheme regarding the retention of national defense information and obstruction of federal investigations. Donald Trump pleaded not guilty in Florida last month to 37 counts against him, which includes 31 charges of illegally holding on to sensitive government records. And Walt Nota entered a non-guilty plea on Thursday after weeks of delays. Walt Nota, Donald Trump's one-time White House valet, is accused of working with the former president to move and hide boxes of documents with classified markings inside Mar-a-Lago and lying to investigators about his knowledge of the records. In all, Jack Smith's two investigations directly cost $5,428,000 in funding from the Justice Department's Permanent Indefinite Funding for Independent Counsel Probes, as prescribed by congressionally authorized statute between 18th of November 2022 and 31st of March 2023. This included more than $2.6 million for personal compensation and benefits, according to the disclosure, and approximately $1.8 million for contractual services like litigation and information technology support. Another $3.8 million was spent on FBI and U.S. Marshals Service personnel connected to the two Jack Smith probes for investigative matters and protective details. While not required to disclose such expenses in the reports, they were included in Friday's statements. Since his appointment, the special counsel Jack Smith has spoken publicly just once after indicting the former president in the Southern District of Florida in June. Our laws that protect national defense information are critical to the safety and security of the United States, and they must be enforced. Jack Smith said at the time, "We have one set of laws in this country, and they apply to everyone." Former President Donald Trump has bashed the probe as politically motivated and maintained he did nothing wrong. Jack Smith's team of prosecutors is also investigating the events surrounding the 6th of January 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol and efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. Grand juries are convened in Washington, D.C. to hear evidence, and in recent weeks, investigators have met with numerous witnesses, including Donald Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani. Investigators have examined a number of leads in the matter and are focused on an alleged fake electoral scheme in which supporters of the former president worked to overturn the certification of the Electoral College votes via an alternate group of swing state representatives pledging their support to Donald Trump, according to sources familiar with the probe. State officials from Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia have spoken with investigators or complied with subpoenas for records in recent months. The expense statements were released as part of a biannual submission by the Justice Department to Congress detailing the cost of ongoing special counsel probes to Congress. The disclosure also contained information related to the investigation of special counsel Robert Hur, who was appointed by Merrick Garland in January to take over the investigation into President Joe Biden's retention of classified documents from his time as vice president and senator, and former special counsel John Durham, who earlier this year completed his probe into the origins of the Russia investigation, according to the report. Robert Hur's investigation cost more than $1.1 million between 12th of January 2023 and 31st of March 2023, as did the final stages of John Durham's probe from 1st of October 2022 to 31st of March 2023. CBS News first reported that roughly 10 documents marked classified were discovered by Joe Biden's personal lawyers at his vice presidential office at the Penn Biden Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement on 2nd of November 2022, and these documents were turned over to the National Archives and Records Administration. The website metro.co.uk has also covered the same story and tells us more. Investigations into former President Donald Trump's alleged classified documents mishandling and efforts to overturn the 2020 election results have cost more than $9 million in just 5 months. The Office of Special Counsel Jack Smith, who is overseeing the probe, spent over $5.4 million on employee salaries, on travel, rent and supplies from November of 2022 to end of March 2023. According to a Justice Department statement of expenditures released on Friday, 7th of July, Justice Department agencies spent an additional $3.8 million to support Jack Smith. The budget summary shows that includes the cost of protective details for the special counsel Jack Smith when warranted. The statement of expenditures was disclosed a few weeks after Donald Trump pleaded not guilty to 37 felony charges around his alleged mishandling of classified documents, and a day after his valet, Walt Nota, pleaded not guilty to 6 charges relating to him allegedly assisting Donald Trump in hiding classified records at Mar-a-Lago. While the Justice Department's investigations into Donald Trump have cost American taxpayers millions of dollars, Donald Trump's indictment in the classified documents case has boosted his 2024 presidential campaign. Donald Trump, on the day after he was criminally charged at a Miami federal courthouse, said the indictment hoax raised him $6.6 million. The former president said that $2.1 million that was donated at his Bedminster Golf Club, where he delivered a speech hours after his arraignment. The other $4.5 million came from digital fundraising. The Justice Department on Friday, 7th of July, also released cost summaries of investigations by 2 other special counsels. Special Counsel John Durham, who was appointed to investigate the FBI's probe of Donald Trump and the Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election, spent $1.1 million from October to March, winding down his inquiry. John Durham's investigation has cost a total of about $7.6 million since he was tasked in 2020 during the Trump administration.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.